Hello there. Today is Tuesday, May 31st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, another missile launch attempt by North Korea. President Obama honors men and women who died while serving in the U.S. military. The Cincinnati Zoo defends its controversial decision to shoot an endangered male lowland gorilla. The Red Planet makes its closest approach to Earth in 11 years.
I'm sure that Mars would almost be directly overhead.
Also ahead, what not to see at the movies. It's all on today's International Edition. And we begin with breaking news out of Asia. Amid growing worldwide concern over North Korea's nuclear and missile activity this year, South Korea's military says the North has made another missile launch attempt. VOA Southeast Asia Bureau Chief Steve Herman joins me now live from Bangkok with the latest. Steve, thank you for being here. You've been following these developments. What do we know at this point?
Well, Lori, what we know at this hour is that this was likely a launch of what is known as the BM-25 or Musudon, an intermediate-range ballistic missile that, according to South Korean authorities, who are not always getting this information accurately based on past events and then leaking the details to the media. But what they're saying is that at 5:20 a.m. local time, the North Koreans attempted to fire or fired into the Sea of Japan from a mobile transport erector launcher near the city of Wonsan, one of these missiles, but they have assessed it to be a failure. They have not given out any details as to how far the missile may have traveled or why they consider it a failure. But this missile apparently has a range of somewhere between 2,500 and 4,000 kilometers. And that means that it could strike the U.S. military bases in Guam, the Philippines, most of China, or even here in Thailand would be considered within the range of a strike by this missile.
Worrisome indeed. Apparently there were clues earlier that this was going to happen. You were reporting on that.
Yes, there was obviously some intelligence information probably based on satellite photography as well as communications intercepts that the North Koreans were preparing this test launch. And both the South Koreans and the Japanese announced that they were taking some proactive defensive measures. And the Japanese, in fact, in central Tokyo at the defense ministry, deployed their own anti-missile units to be in place to actually shoot this thing down if it happened to fly over Japan.
So do officials believe North Korea is actually pretty close to having a missile capable of hitting the U.S. mainland?
Well, what they do have and launched in February, for example, the Unha-3 has a range of 12,000 kilometers. Now, the North Koreans say that is for the peaceful use of launching satellites into space. But, of course, the technology for something you can launch into space is very similar to an intercontinental ballistic missile. The real concern is whether the North Koreans are able or will be able to miniaturize a nuclear weapon that they could place on top of one of these intermediate or long-range missiles.
Is it only a matter of time, given their defiance?
That is the conclusion of a lot of analysts, that eventually, with enough time and money, the North Koreans will get it right and have this sort of capability. Combining that with what they may have been trying to do today, to have this on some type of mobile launcher, that would make it difficult to track the location of the missiles and detect the launch preparation. So there's no doubt that for many years the North Koreans have been working towards that. And this will be discussed at a meeting tomorrow in Tokyo among South Korea, Japan, and the United States. And in fact, this launch today may have been timed to send a signal to those three countries to say, you know, we're aware that you're going to have these talks and we don't like it.
We appreciate it. Southeast Asia Bureau Chief Steve Herman joining us live from Bangkok. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Lori.
And now, of course, we've got the fight for Fallujah. Iraqi forces have entered the Islamic State-held western city in Iraq that was taken by the IS group more than 2 years ago. U.S. Defense spokesman Colonel Steve Warren in Baghdad said Friday that Iraqi forces are moving on multiple fronts and also trying to limit civilian casualties.
We estimate there to be up to 50,000 citizens remaining in Fallujah. They've dropped leaflets to inform the civilian population to avoid ISIL areas. Those leaflets directed those who cannot leave to put white sheets on their roofs to mark their locations. The Iraqi army is working hard to establish evacuation routes, and the local Anbar government has set up camps for displaced civilians.
Families escaping the fighting say Islamic State is forcing them out of their homes and moving them from house to house right in the crossfire. Ambassador James Jeffrey served in Baghdad and is now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty, Iraqi forces have serious challenges in the offensive to retake Fallujah.
Fallujah's a tough nut to crack. There's still somewhere between 30 and 50,000 residents of the city in there. They've been traditionally more pro-Al-Qaeda than anybody else in Iraq, and thus some of them might be fighting with ISIS. Secondly, the very presence of civilians about the dangers of using mass firepower, and you really have to use mass firepower against ISIS. So those are going to be problems. Again, the question is whether they will fight to the bitter end in Fallujah as they did in Ramadi, and they have more troops there. They have between 500 and a couple of thousand. This campaign in both the Syrian, basically it's three separate campaigns. It's the Syrian campaign pushing down from the north towards Raqqa. It's the campaign in Anbar that we just talked about with Fallujah, the main front right now. And then it's a campaign in the north to isolate Mosul. Nobody's ready to go into Mosul yet, but we are isolating it. But basically, this campaign is now much better coordinated, and it's obvious that the president has given his U.S. military commanders far more latitude to put the pressure on ISIS. And the attacks on its oil infrastructure and thus money, its attacks on its leadership, its cutting of communications is now finally beginning to show results.
Are the Peshmerga up to putting this pressure on Mosul eventually to retake it, and how long do you think that'll take?
Kurdish forces are not going to venture very far outside largely Kurdish areas without a lot of U.S. support, more than just some special forces teams. Because if American troops are on the ground, they basically sort of reassure everybody, at least in the short run, that another ethnic force isn't going to take over and ethnically cleanse you and stuff. And that's part of the reason for the Kurds. But the Kurds also don't want to have their troops die for territory they then have to turn over to somebody else. Some of the areas where the Kurds are moving forward are areas that have traditionally been under their control or contain a high percent of Kurds. For that matter, East Mosul was traditionally a significant Kurdish area where the Kurdish Peshmerga always had, up until 2014, a significant security presence. So they could be capable of doing East Mosul. But East Mosul was never the center of Al-Qaeda, and it isn't the center of ISIS. That's West Mosul. That's the bulk of the city, and that's where the real fighting is going to be.
You can read more on our website at voanews.com. As many as 700 or more migrants are feared drowned in recent weeks as they attempted to cross the Mediterranean. Thousands have been rescued by the Italian Navy. Now, the worst incident involved a boat that left Libya Thursday and was being towed by a larger vessel. It began taking on water, and after attempts to keep it afloat failed, the towing boat's captain cut it loose, and as it sank, it trapped many below deck. Giovanna Benedetto of the humanitarian group Save the Children in Sicily spoke to arriving survivors, and she tells VOA the boat was carrying hundreds of mostly African migrants.
From West Africa and East Africa, Somalia, Eritrea, Ethiopia, and also from Nigeria, Ivory Coast, Gambia, Mali, Senegal, these kind of countries. They lived terrible, terrible situation. They told us terrible story. They saw killing people only because those people want to have some food. Their story are really, really terrifying.
Italian police arrested the towboat captain, a 28-year-old Sudanese man whose survivors pointed out. Here in the United States, President Obama hosted a breakfast at the White House for military and veteran service groups, and then, later on Monday, took part in Memorial Day observation at Arlington National Cemetery, where he laid a wreath at the tomb of the unknown soldier.
Everyone here is someone's hero. Those who rest beneath this silence, not only here at Arlington, but at veterans' cemeteries across our country and around the world, and all who still remain missing, they didn't speak the loudest about their patriotism. They let their actions do that.
The Memorial Day holiday honors men and women who died while serving in the U.S. military. The U.S. observes the holiday on the last Monday of May. The three-day weekend is seen as the unofficial start of the summer vacation season. You can read more about it at voanews.com. Here are some of the top stories we are following at voanews.com. A suspicious package forces a partial White House lockdown. Greece rescues 29 migrants adrift at sea on a journey to Italy. A hardline nationalist is sworn in as Israeli defense minister. Turkey's president says family planning is not for Muslims. And a third of parts of the Great Barrier Reef are dead or dying. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more on voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Social media is buzzing with outrage over the shooting death of Harambe, a highly endangered male western lowland gorilla by the Cincinnati Zoo. The incident was captured on video and has outraged animal lovers around the world. More than 200,000 people have signed a petition on the change.org website. Another online petition called Justice for Harambe has attracted 165,000 signatures from people wanting the boy's parents to be charged with negligence. Now, the zoo is defending its controversial decision to shoot and kill the animal after the 4-year-old boy fell into his enclosure Saturday. Zoo director Thane Maynard says officials believed they had no choice. With Harambe's pen surrounded by screaming people, he says the gorilla was clearly agitated, disoriented, and acting erratically.
Harambe, our 17-year-old gorilla male, who's a great big animal, 400 pounds, went down and got him, carried him up into the moat, was moving him around, and it seemed very much by our professional team, our dangerous animal response team, to be a life-threatening situation.
The video shows the gorilla dragging the boy through a shallow moat filled with water. Several times he looked to be gently touching the boy and stood up on both feet as if he was trying to protect him. Maynard called Harambe unpredictable and said tranquilizing the ape would have taken too long. Now let's turn to what's happening on social media with International Edition's G. Abby Lee. Hey, G, what is the buzz today?
Hi, Lori. We talked about hashtag Bernie Trump debate just a few days ago, but that plan may be no more. Democratic presidential contender Bernie Sanders and the presumptive GOP nominee Donald Trump were widely expected to debate in California before the June 7th primary.
Okay, so what happened?
Well, Trump bailed out. He argued the Democratic nominating contest is rigged, and Sanders' rival, Hillary Clinton, will not let him win. He added in that case, it would be inappropriate for him to debate the second-place finisher.
Interesting. So what is the reaction like on Twitter with this?
There's a new hashtag called hashtag Chicken Trump. That's been trending since then.
Okay.
And one of the most liked tweets using that hashtag is from Sarah Silverman. The comedian slash actor tweeted, "You wussy Donald Trump. You are afraid to debate Bernie Sanders? You should be. Hashtag Chicken Trump." More than 15,000 people liked that tweet. I don't know if you know her well, but I just learned about her. She's an American stand-up comedian who addresses taboos and controversial topics in her acts. She's on Twitter at Sarah K. Silverman and has more than 8 million followers. A former congressional staffer named Daniel Bostic, who is clearly not a Trump supporter, quipped, "I have never felt so bad for an animal species in my life. What have chickens ever done to deserve this hashtag? Hashtag Chicken Trump."
That's funny, G. So what are the contenders saying about it?
Not too much on social media, although they are mentioning the presidential race itself. Trump sent out a not-so-subtle attack on Clinton in an apparent bid to solidify his argument on the fact that she and Nat Sanders will be the Democratic nominee. He tweeted, "I would have had millions of votes more in the primaries than crooked Hillary if I only had one opponent instead of 16. Broke record." Sanders, for his part, wrote, "If you want a campaign that can defeat Trump and defeat him badly, we are that campaign." Lori?
All right. Thanks so much, G. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time, Saturdays and Sundays, on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on the Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
International Edition continues. Astronomy buffs across much of the globe awaited darkness on Monday for a glimpse of Mars as the red planet makes its closest approach to Earth in 11 years. But if you missed it, not to worry. It'll still be a sight to see for the next week at least. I talked about it with NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory Solar System Ambassador Greg Redfern. Greg, what can you tell us?
Mars is at its closest since November 2005, and it is a beautifully bright beacon that is high overhead in African skies and will definitely get the attention of anyone looking up.
And all over Earth, it's definitely going to be the closest it's been in a long time and will be for a long time?
Yes, the nice thing is, whether you're Northern Hemisphere or Southern Hemisphere, that does not affect Mars being close to us. Because Mars has a 26-month cycle in which it gets close to the Earth. The next time we get to see Mars, it'll even be closer, Lori, will be July 2018. But this close approach on May 30th being the closest is the best we've had in over a decade. So that makes it special.
And it'll be close for a little bit. Correct?
Even yes, though this is not going to be something that now that May 30th comes and goes, that Mars is no longer visible. It'll be as bright as it is tonight until about June 3rd, and then Mars will still be very bright in the sky, and people will begin to notice over the span of a couple weeks leading into the first day of summer that Mars will be getting a little bit dimmer. But it'll still command our attention as we see it in the sky because it's right next to our glorious summer Milky Way galaxy in the Northern Hemisphere, or the Milky Way galaxy as seen in the Southern Hemisphere. It's very, very striking when you see that, Lori.
And if you're looking up at the sky, how do you know you're seeing Mars, or will it be obvious?
Yeah, the thing what we have to be aware of is that in the highest portion of the sky in Africa, Mars will be a bright yellowish-orange color, very, very distinctive. And it's in the constellation of Scorpius for any people that really know the sky, but it's going to be to the right of the Milky Way, which is a dead giveaway. And the only thing that's really competing with Mars is Jupiter. But Jupiter is far to the west. It may not even be visible at the same time that you see Mars, depending on your location. But the distinctive color, as people can see in your online web with the pictures that we have, very, very distinctive, very, very by itself, and especially next to that Milky Way.
There are certain places, it's summertime here in Washington, D.C., but there are places on Earth where it's wintertime. So do they
Southern Hemisphere.
Right. So do they have an advantage?
Well, the advantage that they have, Lori, is that in the Southern Hemisphere, Mars will be higher overhead than it is for anybody in the Northern Hemisphere. Matter of fact, I'm sure that Mars would almost be directly overhead, depending on your viewing location, because as I said, down in Africa, you can be at 47 south and 30 degrees south, and that makes Mars a heck of a lot higher than you could possibly see it in the Northern Hemisphere. So they are a distinct advantage of being able to have a higher in the sky view of Mars. And one other thing I'd like to let them know is there are currently 5 spacecraft from Europe, NASA, and India in orbit around Mars observing the planet, and we have 2 rovers, Opportunity and Curiosity, that are mapping and exploring the surface of Mars. It is an amazing planet.
All right. Thanks so much, Greg. Greg Redfern, NASA JPL Solar System Ambassador, will be talking with Greg regularly, and we will include your questions in future episodes. So if you have space-related questions, please tweet them to @SkyGuyInVA. You can also follow me at Lori London. That's LoriLundin. Well, a lot of Americans headed to the theaters this holiday weekend, and maybe this week, in hopes of seeing one of the newly released movies. Jeffrey K. Howard of VegasFilmCritic.com joined me in studio to talk about a couple of them. Hey, Jeff, what's big at the box office?
Well, the big elephant in the room is, of course, the long-awaited X-Men sequel, X-Men Apocalypse. And this is with the younger cast. So this is actually a sequel to of the previous X-Men where they're younger, you know. So it's kind of hard to keep all these, keep them all track, because there's like 10 or 11 of them keep bouncing around. So this one has the origins of Apocalypse, who is considered the first mutant, and he's back in ancient Egyptian times. And of course, he's rebelled against, and he's trapped for thousands of years. Well, he wakes up, sees the modern world, and goes, well, wait a minute, you know, I want to rule this. But he starts destroying everything, but he needs some of the X-Men's help because he can absorb their powers. So it's almost like Captain America Civil War we had earlier this summer, where the Avengers were split in half. Well, now we have some of the X-Men becoming bad guys, and we have some of the X-Men being the good guys. So we have this 2.5-hour 3D extravaganza of the X-Men fighting the ultimate mutant Apocalypse, played by Oscar Isaac. Now, here's the problem. Mm-hmm. He is a weak villain. He is absolutely corny and weak, and overall the movie just doesn't have the spark, and it doesn't have it's confusing, and it's just, I think the X-Men is starting to play out like the Spider-Man movies have, where it's just not becoming, it's not intriguing audiences, and it's getting more and more complicated, but it's for more comic book fans. I have comic book fans coming up saying, well, wait a minute, this character was this and this, and they start going through all these incredible details. I go, look, it needs to be a movie, not a 20 comic book series, you know? So I didn't like it. I was disappointed in it, but it did like $80 million so far this opening weekend. So fans are going crazy over it. But overall, I thought the average moviegoer is going to be bored with it.
What about this other one, Alice Through the Looking Glass? Is this sort of an adult version of Alice in Wonderland?
Well, no, this is technically the sequel to the Tim Burton movie from 2012, but it's from Walt Disney Pictures, and it stars Johnny Depp again as the Mad Hatter. And this time Alice is grown up, and she goes back to Wonderland by total accident through the looking glass, where she finds the Mad Hatter is depressed because he misses his family. We find out that the family of the Mad Hatter was killed by the Jabberwocky, the dragon-like creature. So she must find the timekeeper, played by Sacha Baron Cohen, and travel through time. I know, can you believe that? A time travel movie. Yeah, it's bad enough when we see it through Star Trek, trying to keep track of everything. Can you imagine bouncing around the timeline in Wonderland? And that's exactly what happened, because it gets so confusing and so crazy that there's no fun in this movie. Johnny Depp is just borderline psychotic in this movie. And Sacha Baron Cohen is the only thing that's kind of cool with the timekeeper, but it's already bombed. I mean, it has landed with a thud at the box office, and rightly so. It is unimaginative, and poor Disney, and Johnny Depp is in the headlines with all his troubles. So this is a really, really disappointment for a lot of his fans.
Tell us, yes. Because a lot of people listening may not know what's up with Johnny Depp, why he's in the headlines.
Yes, well, Johnny Depp, just on opening day, can you leave Disney executives with their hands over their face screaming, into their pillows, his wife filed for a restraining order, accusing him of beating her and cruel and unusual punishment. So it's just the headlines and pictures of her all over the internet and this publicity just as the movie was opening. So he's getting a lot of flack for that unfortunate situation. But you know what? The movie itself is bad. So don't, even though what Johnny Depp has done and never condoned that, but the movie itself really is a horrible mixture, a mess of just 3D headaches. So we have two movies this weekend that, in my opinion, aren't worth your price of admission.
All right. Thanks so much, Jeffrey K. Howard. Always appreciate your honesty. You can see Jeff's full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. That is going to do it for this edition of International Edition. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, and you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Charles Hall. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Vital blood service for millions of Ethiopians will improve thanks to a new cooperative effort between the United States and Ethiopia. Ethiopian Minister of Health, Dr. Ketisa Birhan Admasu, and USAID Ethiopia Mission Director Dennis Weller recently led a groundbreaking ceremony in Addis Ababa to kick off construction for the National Blood Transfusion Service Center. The new center will provide the Ministry of Health with additional capacity to receive donations, screen and process blood products, and distribute life-saving products to serve approximately 26 million Ethiopians. The 5,300 square meter facility will house the administrative headquarters for blood transfusion services, providing a permanent home for offices, training, meetings, and document storage. One of the primary reasons for strengthening and expanding blood transfusion services in Ethiopia is to reduce the prevalence of HIV in the blood supply. The new center will enable the staff to properly screen blood for HIV and other infections after it is collected. Speaking at the event, Mr. Weller said a key reason for improving blood transfusion services in Ethiopia is to reduce the number of maternal deaths. Hemorrhaging continues to be one of the leading causes of maternal mortality in Ethiopia, and many of these deaths can be prevented through blood transfusions. Mr. Weller commended the Ministry of Health's contributions to the many months of planning, design, and the beginning of the construction of the new National Blood Transfusion Service Center. The capacity of this facility will enable the ministry to meet more than 25% of the World Health Organization's recommended annual blood collection goals for Ethiopia. Additionally, the center will oversee the distribution of blood products, which will expand access to blood transfusion services throughout rural and urban areas of Ethiopia. The $5 million construction cost is funded by the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR. USAID is expected to complete construction of the facility in 2 years. The United States is proud to work with its longtime partner, Ethiopia, to help improve this and other health services for the people of Ethiopia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials. We'll be right back.
is 4.